the monologue.
Dare I say that if you have to provide a free webinar in order to train workers that don't actually work for the government, but train them to, quote unquote, de-escalate the situations in which customers might get mad as a result of a policy that you forced upon them, maybe you should rethink the policy. Maybe that is a sign that this policy is not the right thing to implement. And yet here we are with the Seattle Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce holding webinars for businesses, at least one as of right now, being held for businesses to give them some tools, some training on how to enforce the proof of vaccination. And part of it is, how do you deal with some of the people who are upset? Now, the Chamber of Commerce CEO, Rachel Smith, spoke with King 5 today. And she says they're doing what they can, not necessarily because they want to, but they're giving this training because they want to hang on to as many customers as possible.
The last thing any of our businesses want to do is turn a customer away.
They don't want to turn any customer away. And believe me, I totally understand that. They don't want to have to enforce the mandate. They're in that position. And maybe because they don't want to have to do it, there's a reason why we're not getting much of this enforcement.
And the reality is, the enforcement right now, it's mostly an honor system.
It's mostly an honor system. And that, again, is kind of instructive. We have the King County executive telling us that it is imperative that you have this mandate in place. Otherwise, people are going to get COVID and die. Data doesn't actually back that up, but that's what they want you to believe, because they think that kind of fear is going to get you to get the vaccine if you're not interested. Now, very few people in this area are completely resistant to the vaccine, right? You have over 90%, some, what was it, 94%, 92% of the Seattle, King County area that has at least one vaccine shot. That's a lot of people. Most people here are vaccinated. Far and away, most people here are vaccinated. And yet, the executive wasn't content with that. He needed more, and he wants more and more and more and more and some more. And so he puts in place this vaccine passport system, which is nonsense. It's a crock. It's a scam. It's not actually going to help keep anyone safer than they already were. And it's not even being enforced. So if this was supposed to be that sort of last gap between death from COVID or safety from it, wouldn't you think they would want it enforced and actually go out into the community, go into these businesses and actually force them to enforce? Actually say, hey, if you don't do this the right way, we're going to fine you? No, that's the same reason why they said, despite a mandate that's statewide at the time, that's why no one from the governor's office went on over and gave a hard time to the folks who were running Lumen Field for the Seahawks game. Seahawks fans with their masks off. Again, there's no risk to being outside. There's virtually no risk to being outside and catching COVID. That is what the actual science and data suggests. And yet somehow they are being put on this mandate. You have to wear your mask on top of showing your vaccine passport or recently negative. It's just absolute nonsense. And the reason why they're not enforcing it is because they know enforcing it isn't going to change anything. They can do literally nothing at this point, and nothing will change. The virus will spread as it would normally spread, or go away for a bit as it would normally go away. That's how it works. But for Rachel, she's just basically saying, look, we want to make sure that people are comfortable with the rules in place, so we're doing this webinar. That's what we're doing for them.
We really want staff to feel confident asking customers to do what they need to do, whether that's wear a mask or show proof of vaccination.
And I have a lot of sympathy for the businesses that don't want to do this, but they're only doing this so that they can stay open. Brian Teal, for example, he's the co-owner of Ghost Fish Brewing Company. And he is participating in this webinar because he just wants to know what kind of info he can take away from it.
I think that there definitely was some concern as far as how it would go. Any resources that we can get our hands on that's going to help educate us, help motivate us, point us in the right direction. If there's best practices that we can learn from other businesses.
I think the best practice is not to practice it at all, but obviously I don't want companies to put themselves in a position where they could truly end up getting some sort of consequence as a result. Is that going to happen? As of right now, definitely not.
Having people in here, like what we've got, tonight is how, we really survive and grow.
Yeah. And again, I'm compassionate. I really do empathize with that. I'm not going to be one of those customers. Not yet. I'm not going to participate in this because I think it's wrong. At some point, will I be forced into participating? Yes, but I'm going to hold out until I can.
The interview
There's an op-ed that caught my attention in the Washington Post. It's called, "In D.C., American Jews Continue to Face Anti-Semitism Unabated," and has a lot to do with a pretty high-profile instance of pretty blatant Jew hatred. And it's always fascinating to have these conversations when folks who are very clearly anti-Semites say, "We don't hate Jews, we're just against Zionism." Oh, okay, thanks. Brooke Goldstein actually is the person who wrote this piece. She's a human rights attorney and founder and executive director for the Lawfare Project. She joins me now. Brooke, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Take us through what happened with this nonprofit called Sunrise DC.
So basically what happened with them is what's happening all over our great country, which is the exclusion and targeting of Jewish groups and Jewish people and using foreign politics as an excuse. Sunrise DC is really a nothing movement that has said they focus on climate change issues. But when it came to participating in a coalition with mainstream Jewish groups, refused to participate, saying that they will not participate with groups that support the state of Israel, with groups that are Zionist, and walked out, Basically. They didn't acknowledge that there were other groups who also support the right of the Jewish people to self-sovereignty and support our civil rights movement called Zionism. They only mentioned the Jewish group. So right away, that smacked of bigotry and racism. But even worse is, again, the refusal to associate with a Jewish organization and requiring that Jewish organization reject their own cultural, religious, and ethnic identity in order for you to participate with them. That is racism.
It is racism, but they don't see it that way. And they try to separate out this idea of Zionism and Judaism. And you make a point in your piece that it's like trying to separate out someone who is Chinese from being considered Asian. It just doesn't quite work that way.
Exactly. I mean, you're always going to find Jews who say that they don't identify as Zionists. But the truth is that Zionism, which is the civil rights movement of the Jewish people, is as intrinsic to our cultural identity as it is to expressions of the Jewish identity. And to deny that the Jewish people have a right to self-sovereignty in their ancestral homeland is bigotry. But what's worse is saying that you won't identify with someone because of your opinions of a foreign state. So, for example, let's say that I am angry at China because of COVID. That doesn't excuse me to go to a Chinese person at school or someone who runs a Chinese restaurant and discriminate against them and hate them because they are Chinese, because that's their ethnic identity. If I have a problem with the government of Sudan, I don't go around and discriminate against black people. If I have a problem with Iran, that doesn't excuse me from discriminating against Muslims. But if you have a problem with Israel, a foreign state, that is a legitimate excuse in most liberal circles to then use that to discriminate against Jewish people.
So Sunrise, the national movement, said that the statement that was made by Sunrise DC, the local group, are not in line with their values. Then you have Sunrise DC putting out a statement that I think they want us to believe is an apology, but it's not. And I'll give you the last word on this just real quickly. We're committed to learning and growing as we continue to stand against Zionism, anti-Semitism, anti-Palestinian racism, and other forms of oppression. In 30 seconds, if you could, tell us why that's a nonsense statement.
It's a nonsense statement because they are unable to unequivocally condemn racism and bigotry against Jewish people without couching it in some broader notions of anti-racism and tying it to other minority communities. And not only that, they reaffirmed that they were anti-Zionist, basically telling the world that they do not support the right of the Jewish people to self-sovereignty and civil rights. It's a blatant announcement of bigotry.
There you go. Brooke Goldstein is the founder and executive director of the Lawfare Project. This is a pro bono legal group that helps Jewish people worldwide deal with civil and human rights issues. Go to thelawfareproject.org if you want to learn more about this really good group. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me and for focusing on this issue.
Absolutely. And people should check it out. The op-ed is over at the Washington Post.
The monologue.
Sounds like an incident in North Bend was resolved without the need for a social worker. And I'm glad we didn't send that social worker, because that social worker would be dead right now. An incident happened yesterday where a 33-year-old man ended up getting shot and killed by police. It happened at a park in North Bend. It happened last night around 11 p.m. or so over at Torgerson Park. This is a park that closes at 9 p.m. and yet this person was still there. According to Bellevue Police, they said a Snoqualmie North Bend officer approached a group of people at this park. There was some kind of altercation. Not entirely sure what it was yet, but it escalated very quickly. Debbie Christopherson, she's with Bellevue PD. She's with the Independent Force Investigation Team with King County, and she spoke with Cairo 7 TV to explain what we know, at least as of now.
We have been advised that there was an altercation between an officer and a 33-year-old subject. We do know that shots were fired. The subject is deceased, and so we're working this investigation.
So in other words, don't have all that much information. Now, we've subsequently learned that this individual apparently tried to reach for this officer's gun. The officer grabbed it first and used it on this suspect. But beyond that, we don't really have any of the details. We know that the officer wasn't hurt, thank God. We know that there have been interviews so far with witnesses, but they're saying they're hearing some conflicting stories. In fact, Major Christopherson said, we've heard different stories of a group being out there to just the individual being out here, so I'm not sure. So they don't know yet. But they are working as part of this newly formed King County Independent Force Investigation Team over in Bellevue. It's actually the first time that this team has been used to investigate police use of deadly force. It's the first time it's been used. So we'll obviously try to get a better sense of what exactly happened. But until then, doesn't it sound like, let's just say there was a group of people who were out. Maybe they were making some noise. Maybe they were being rowdy in a park that was closed. That's not an emergency you would generally send an officer to. In a world in which you had social workers, you would probably send your social worker there. Well, if this person, if the story is accurate that he was part of a group or even just alone, you send out a social worker and this guy does the same thing to that social worker as he allegedly tried to do this cop, and presumably with the intent to do serious harm and or kill this person, this cop, what do you think would have happened? What do you think would have happened if we sent out that social worker? There's no reason to believe that this group was going to be rowdy. There's no reason to believe that they would be dangerous. In fact, if you're one of the folks on the left, you can make the argument, don't send a cop. That cop is armed. It's going to trigger these folks. It's going to get escalated really, really quickly. You can't de-escalate when you've got a gun on your hip. Go ahead and send Susie the social worker. And maybe if you want to be safe, well, it is kind of late. Why don't you, hey, Danny, why don't you go? Go as well. Well, if this suspect was willing to do what he did to a cop, what do you think he might do to someone who's got zero training in self-defense? Something tells me it's not going to end well. There are lots of people who have nothing to do with policing. There's lots of people who don't even talk to police. They don't go and see what they're about, what it is they do, how they do it. They don't do ride-alongs. They're the ones who come up with these kinds of policies. The people who hate cops the most seem to have the loudest voice as well. And they think, well, why would you ever need to send a cop here? There's no danger. There's no emergency. There's barely a crime. Oh, what are you going to do? Give a ticket for being out in a park past the 9 p.m. curfew? They end up sending a social worker. The social worker ends up getting hurt. That's how it's going to work time and time and time again. We've had instances in which even in retrospect, you're like, okay, well, probably maybe we should have sent that social worker. Okay, yeah, send the social worker to go try to figure out what's going on with Charlena Lyles, who decided to lie about a robbery. The argument being you don't need to send cops with guns to an armed robbery attempt or break-in in that case. Why don't we send, it doesn't have to be a social worker, but maybe social worker light. Why don't we send them out there and actually have them talk to the people, talk to the victim. Well, if they did that with Charlena Lyles, they'd be dead. Cops had to use a gun because Charlena Lyles was lunging at them with a kitchen knife after luring them into her apartment. I'd rather be doing stories about suspects who ended up getting hurt because they acted improperly rather than hearing about the social workers getting hurt because the city or the state leaders who put in place these different policies on policing, they put them on the line. I'd prefer not to have to do those stories. I don't want the story of the social worker who was shot and killed or stabbed as a result of responding to a crime. Call me crazy.
The interview.
Well, a lot of work gets done right now as we are a few weeks away from the next legislative session, but the lawmakers are at work trying to figure out what they're going to handle in such a limited amount of time when you have just so much to talk about, so much to help address. Joining me on the line is State Representative Andrew Barkas, who is pushing for a different way to go about funding transportation in this state. Welcome back to the show. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Jason. It's always a pleasure to be on with you and to chat about all things important affecting the state of Washington.
Yeah,
so,
no kidding.
Here's another one.
Well, transportation is obviously really important on the surface when you talk about new funding methods. It's not necessarily the sexiest topic, but it's incredibly important. So tell us what you're thinking.
Well, Jason, you know, it's no secret. Our transportation system has been in a state of chaos for the last several years. And it's getting worse. Our infrastructure and maintenance and preservation. And we've had severe challenges in budgeting over the last couple of years because of declining revenues when it comes to the gas tax and other fees that support it. So every time we get to this point, you hear the call for a revenue transportation package. And that's code for let's raise the gas tax.
Yep.
Let's raise fees, which is what has been the methodology for the last 20 years. And as I started looking at this, I think there's a better way of doing that, and that is let's look at the revenue that we have coming into the entirety of the state, and let's reprioritize that to take care of our transportation needs. And so I have been working on what I'm calling the Real Transportation Act. It is not a transportation revenue package. It is a new way of thinking about holistically the budgets, all the budgets in the state of Washington, and the interconnectedness between them, and using some of those revenues out of the general operating budget to take care of our transportation needs.
And so, yeah, so you're basically saying we're going to do more with what we have. We're just going to do it in a slightly different way.
Yes. I mean, you know, what we've seen is the operating budget has had double-digit increases in revenue year after year after year. And we just saw the most miraculous recovery after COVID, a quicker recovery than was ever anticipated since even the Great Recession. And what it tells us is that our tax system is very healthy and the revenue coming in is healthy. The problem is that what happens in the general operating budget is whatever comes in, they spend. And it's creating more programs and more things that we have to deal with in the future. I think what we should be doing is using those revenues to deal with the priorities that we have in front of us. And transportation should be at the top of that list. We have an infrastructure that needs help. We have projects that do need to get done. And you can't have a robust economy in the state of Washington without a robust transportation system. And so if that money is coming into the state coffers from the taxpayers, well, we should reprioritize that and use some of that with the transportation arena.
Do you think we also have to just rethink the way we tackle the projects and just the scope of these projects and what we go after? I keep thinking several years ago under then Secretary of Transportation Lynn Peterson constantly telling us you can't build your way out of congestion.
Right.
And then, of course, we have, you know, I-5 over near JBLM. That's exactly what they did. They built it, their way out of congestion.
Right. Well, I think that there is, you know, there are many things that we need to be talking about. Reform is one of them. How we do our projects, the impacts on the policy and the laws that we continually pass that adds to the regulatory burden of doing these projects, especially when it comes to climate policy, environmental policy, and you know everything that is piled on takes time, and time is money, and so these projects get delayed. They cost more money. But you also have an ideological and a philosophical change in our state, starting from the executive branch down into the transportation division with the secretary there, that thinks of things differently.
Mm-hmm.
I think of things, we need to build roads. We need to maintain our bridges. We need to make sure that people can get from point A to point B and not have to sit in their car for 3 hours a night. There are different things that we need to be doing. And that's why I really do not think it is appropriate for us to be thinking of another list of projects to build when we haven't even finished the ones that we put into play from the last transportation revenue package. I think we need to look at everything that we're doing right now, finish what we've started, use these existing revenues by shifting things around between the budgets, and then having that broader conversation on how we can do this better. Because we can. And the work that I've been doing over the last several years as a ranking member has made it evident that we can do a better job if we work together and we look at this thing collaboratively. And that's what I'm proposing.
It makes sense to me, which means I don't know if it'll make sense to the Democrats. You might have to explain it a few times. We've been talking with State Representative Andrew Barkas, Republican from Olympia. Thank you so much for stopping by. We wish you best of luck on this idea, and we'll be sure to follow up.
Thank you.
And help put some pressure on lawmakers to get it done.
I appreciate that. More information will be coming out here in the next couple of weeks as we gear towards session here in January. And I'm looking forward to the work ahead and the conversations and leading on this issue as we move into the future. Perfect.
Love it. I've been talking with State Rep Andrew Barkas. Thank you so much for stopping by, as always. Really appreciate it.
You bet.
The Jason Rantz Show.
Always glad to see Seattle radio host Jason Rantz.
It's always a pleasure to watch you and a pleasure now to host you.
Jason, I just love your coverage of what's been going on in Seattle.
Jason, this is as bad as it gets in America.
Jason Rantz, great to see you. Thank you.
Long Form, presented by Northgate Rare Coins and Precious Metals.
Well, for the first time in about six decades, we have a Democrat Secretary of State. And the only way, of course, we get something like that is if we allow someone like Governor Jay Inslee to make that appointment. Now, on the surface, it might seem that State Senator Stephen Hobbs of Lake Stevens is a reasonable choice. He, after all, is a moderate Democrat. But my next guest says, whoa, 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 let's start and look at the big picture here. Joining me on the line is the pride of Puyallup. He's the chairman of the Washington State GOP, Caleb Heimlich. Caleb, welcome back to the show. Your first reaction to this news was what?
Yeah, this is really a blatantly crass political move from Governor Inslee. So he could have chosen any number of people. He claims in his statement, I wanted an independent. Well, he could have picked an actual political independent. There are lots of nonpartisan county elected auditors across the state with elections experience. He could have selected one of them. He said, I want somebody that has experience and can bring people together. Well, he could have chosen one of our living former Secretary of States, Ralph Monroe, Bruce Chapman, Sam Reed, anybody like that. There was any number of people he could pick. But the reason he selected Senator Steve Hobbs was because Hobbs has been an obstacle to Inslee's radical agenda. On issues from the carbon tax to the capital gains income tax, Hobbs was often on the other side voting with Republicans. And so Inslee is counting on the local Democratic Party to appoint a rubber stamp for his agenda to take that Senate seat. And this falls right in line with last year we saw Governor Inslee endorse a progressive challenger to Senator Mark Mullett. Mm-hmm. And so we know Governor Inslee will stop at nothing to get his political agenda through, pushing past norms. Even today, thankfully, the state Supreme Court ruled 7-2 that one of his vetoes, a line item veto, was overreach, executive overreach, and it was unconstitutional. And so that's good. But this is just frustrating that Governor Inslee is playing politics, is using this decision not as an opportunity to select somebody that would be good for the job and would administer elections in a fair manner and inspire voter confidence in our elections, but he used the resignation and stepping away of Kim Wyman as a chance to further his political agenda and his own political ambitions, which is all he seems to care about.
Is this an opportunity to pick up his seat when it's actually up for re-election? I mean, obviously, when looking at Hobbs, he was representing an area that it's more purple at this point than blue, and he was able to get away with it. Is this now, all of a sudden, you get some Seattle-style Democrat that represents the area? It seems like a potential pickup for us long-term.
Absolutely, yes. And that seat will be up next November. And there is a chance, obviously it'll be kind of musical chairs on the Democratic side. They may appoint one of their House members to the Senate seat. And so then we've got a new senator because Hobbs was relatively popular and he had a moderate voting record on taxes, on other economic issues. And so if you get a radical Seattle Democrat that's just rubber stamping Inslee's session. Absolutely, the 44th Senate seat is in play, and the House seats are both in play as well. And so that does open up kind of another front in our goal to get back 4 Senate seats and 8 House seats next November. So looking down the road, certainly there is a silver lining of opportunity there. But the concern is what's going to happen this legislative session, because now Inslee could push even further for a carbon tax or other tax bills. And we have 21 Republican senators. Oftentimes we've had 3 moderate Democrats in Mollett, Hobbs, and Vandewedge. And then you just needed one more and you could block bills. And now one of those moderate Democrats that was inclined to oppose the most radical elements of Inslee's agenda is gone, and that removes that obstacle this legislative session. So that's a big concern.
Is there any Democrat that's coming to mind as a possible replacement that the party would be looking at?
Any Democrat for Secretary of State, you mean?
No, a Democrat to be appointed to Hobbs' position.
Oh,
who do you think that they're even looking at?
I would imagine oftentimes that they would look at the 2 House members, which would be Representative April Berg and Representative John Lovick, who are both to the left of Senator Hobbs. Aside from that, I'm not sure. But I mean, typically with an appointment process, you're going to have party faithful making the appointment, and they're going to pick a party line person for that seat.
Well, let's say they went with Lovick, for example, who has weirdly gone further to the left than I thought he would, as someone who's former law enforcement. But let's say they make that move. You generally believe that the Senate seat would be a potential opportunity for Republicans. Well, then Lovick's old seat, is that more? He's more, I think, in line with sort of being out of touch with his district, but he does have great name recognition.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, whether it's Berg or Lovick, you're now introducing a brand new person, and it's essentially an open seat. And so I think there was already an opportunity in the one House seat. I mean, Mark James, who's on the Marysville City Council, ran against April Berg. He got 48%+ of the vote in 2020. So I already felt like we had a good shot to replace Representative Berg next year. Lovick has been there a long time, but I think in a Senate seat where there's a little bit more money spent, because there's 4 times as many House seats up every election as there are Senate seats. So the Senate seats oftentimes have about 4 or 5 times as much spending. So you can really dive into more of those votes. You can dive into how their agenda hasn't fit their constituents. So I think the Senate seat will absolutely be in play, whether it's Lovick or Berg or somebody else. And I think now potentially both House seats, or at least one House seat, absolutely we have a shot. And that's a good chunk of, again, the 4 Senate seats and the 8 House seats we need. And so we'll definitely be very active in the 44th, obviously finally contingent upon redistricting, which hopefully we get those maps next Monday.
So we only have a minute left. Just real quick, Caleb, what does this say for the Secretary of State position under Hobbs? He is still moderate. Do you think he's going to be fair?
I do. He has a military career. I think he will be a fine in the role. Of course, I'm going to be working hard to find a Republican to run.
Sure.
I think there's a good chance that the Democrats primary him because Hobbs has run statewide twice. He ran for lieutenant governor. Well, I should say he ran for lieutenant governor in 2016, lost in the primary because he wasn't liberal enough, and then was running for lieutenant governor in 2020 and then chose to drop out. And then we had the Denny Heck, Marco Elias thing. But all that to say, I wouldn't be surprised if the Democrats push a radical primary challenger to him. And we're certainly working hard to find a capable, qualified Republican to replace him. But in terms of our elections next year, obviously a lot of it is done at the county level. And so that's where we need people monitoring and being involved with the county process.
Yep.
But I don't think in 1 year in the job, Senator Hobbs is going to kind of destroy the secretary or anything like that.
Well, I guess that's the glass half full approach, at least in regards to that appointment. We've been talking with Caleb Heimlich. Of course, he's the chairman of the Washington State GOP. You can learn more at WSRP.org. Caleb, thank you so much for stopping by, as always. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Jason.
Absolutely.
The Jason Rantz Show.
Jason Rantz, Seattle radio host, joins us now.
Jason, you're the perfect guest on this.
Jason Rantz, welcome back, Jason.
I see you often on other programs here.
Jason, what's going on?
Jason, thanks for coming on.
The Quick Hit.
Let's talk about a press conference that happened today. It's all in the name of pushing a climate change project, an agenda, obviously to end climate change as we know it. And to be clear, climate change is real. The climate changes all the time. I consider myself an environmentalist, not by the standards of the left, but I want to protect the environment as best we can. It doesn't even have anything necessarily to do with global warming, but just being good stewards of our land. I think that there are benefits to that. I think nature is incredibly important. I don't enjoy nature in the sense of going out on hikes all the time, but I don't want to be surrounded by garbage. And if that means you have even a minuscule effect on whether or not the planet gets warmer or colder, whatever it is, okay, that's cool, added benefit. What I'm not willing to do is give up on capitalism, which is usually at the sort of, it's one of the underlying issues concerning or pushing from the left this topic of climate change, that they're not so much interested in protecting the environment as much as they are interested in attacking capitalism and then replacing it with an economic system that it's not necessarily socialist, depends on who you're talking to, but would greatly diminish what it is we have right now, which I think does great benefit to society. I think a capitalist system is the best system, and we've been shown that to be the case time and time and time again. Doesn't mean that you don't ever make changes to anything. You don't make tweaks when you have to, but to be clear, this is the best economic system that we have. People like AOC and others don't like that. Ed Markey doesn't like that. He's a senator from Oregon. Excuse me, Massachusetts. I don't know why I said Oregon. From Massachusetts. And what I find to be curious about this is we're now hearing the sort of the mantle of climate change being used to go after Republicans in even more disingenuous ways. We always knew that, you know, when you do a political attack, and in fairness, when folks on the right do political attacks, they too are doing things in disingenuous ways. Political attacks are political attacks. You're doing it for politics. And if you're doing something for political reasons, it means you either have something to gain directly or indirectly. Right now, Democrats have a lot to gain if they're able to change the narrative and blame Republicans on not climate change, but something connected to climate change, like rising oil prices. All of a sudden, this is being blamed on the Republicans. You have record high gas rates, depending on where it is you live, rates that you didn't have under the Trump administration. You have even in Seattle, we went over the numbers yesterday. What was it? 47% increase in gas prices ish around that. I mean, that's remarkable. And that hurts people, the people who rely on their car for work, whether it's because they drive long commutes to get to work or if it's due to the fact that they literally work in their car, carpenters, plumbers, folks like that, contractors who go from job site to job site, housekeepers who go from job site to job site, whatever it is, they end up getting hurt. And the pain is being felt in a very real way. And that's why Joe Biden's approval numbers are so in the dumps. I mean, they are doing so poorly right now, this administration. And part of the reason is because of gas prices. It's one of the many reasons, but it's one of the reasons. I want to listen to Senator Markey today at this press conference on global warming or climate change try to shift the blame to the GOP for rising oil prices.
Right now, oil companies are taking American consumers and shaking them upside down at gas pumps all across our country, while simultaneously sending a signal to the Republican Party to kill Build Back Better, to kill a transition to all electric vehicles, to plug-in hybrids, to battery storage technologies that will lead inevitably to the demise of those companies controlling the agenda of our nation. If we're afraid of Russia's agenda right now,
okay,
Saudi Arabia's control over our foreign policy in the Middle East, there's one sure and certain thing that we can do, and it's over the next month, and that is to make sure that we have both of those countries and others like them on a pathway to bankruptcy, because the oil era will be over if we pass this bill.
Okay. No, it won't. If anyone is dumb enough on the left to think that the quote unquote, the oil era is done by passing this one bill. You have no clue what it is you're talking about. You don't understand the oil industry. And frankly, you don't understand what's in this bill, if that's what you actually think. And we know, as a matter of fact, that that's absolute nonsense. In fact, they scaled back even just some of the commitments on electric vehicles, in this new version of the Build Back Better plan. So there is something right now that can be done to address the oil crisis, the high price of oil. Right now, there's something that can be done. Well, two things, actually. Number one, you could not continue to cancel different programs like different projects like, oh, I don't know, the Keystone XL pipeline, which you canceled, which not only cost American jobs, thousands of them. You made it easier for OPEC to have even more control over oil transportation, which makes it more expensive to get into this country. The barrels go up because of that. Yes, I know it has a lot to do with supply and demand as well. But, you know, you could have kept that particular project. And number two, you could have actually decided to do more of it here. You do realize that you can drill for oil here. In our country, in our region, you can drill for oil. You can do domestic exploration. They're choosing not to do it. They could do fracking. It's much safer than a lot of people want to talk about. But people who are just so anti-oil will say no to that. And as a result, they end up hurting the very people that they claim to want to help by getting us off of oil. We're nowhere near ready to get off of oil. Not even close. You could right this moment go into our strategic reserve. We have crude oil that is being held. We've got, what, 600 and something million barrels right now? Right now, you have a little over 621 million barrels, according to Forbes. You could dip into that. You can do that at this point just to give a little bit of some help to the American people. You're choosing not to do it. You are choosing not to do it. So don't tell me that the only way that we can actually help things is to build back better and those gosh darn Republicans standing in the way because they've got big oil money in there. No, that's not how it works. He knows that's not how it works, but he thinks you don't know how it works.
The last rants.
And with that, I give you my last rants for this month, because after today's show, I'm gone. In fact, right now, I'm getting ready to head to the airport. I'm going on vacation. I'll be back on Monday after Thanksgiving. You'll have some fill-in for me tomorrow, and Friday will be Brian Suits. Monday and Tuesday of next week will be Brandy Cruz. We'll stop by and do my show. And then you've got some best of for the holidays. And I like to pretend that I'm not going to do any work while on vacation. That, of course, is nonsense. I've not taken a vacation, a true vacation, where I haven't actually worked since I became an adult. And lots of people say that that's not healthy. You're supposed to just completely disconnect. I'll be mostly disconnected from the day-to-day stuff, but I'm still going to be writing. I'm doing a lot of Fox News hits as of right now. Obviously, that can change depending on the news cycle. I think I'm going to be on Fox at least three times from London. That's already on the books. So I'm going to continue to work. And my rant wants to go towards the people who say you should completely disconnect. My response to that is you should mind your own business. If you want to completely disconnect and that works for you and it works for the people around you, the ones that you work for, go ahead and completely disconnect. I will continue to work where I think it's appropriate, where I feel the need to. Work for me is a little bit different than work for some others. I feel called to the work that I do. I feel called. There's something inside me that makes me want to write a story, that makes me want to broadcast my thoughts. There is some drive inside me. I can't pinpoint it, don't know where it's coming from, don't know why it's there, but I am driven in that way. And if I feel that drive when I'm on vacation, don't give me this nonsense of you should just take time off. I am. I'm going to London. I'm going to spend a lot of time off. Most of my time there will be spent offline from a work perspective, but not all of it. So I'm pre-yelling, I'm proactively yelling at the people who will tell me or tell you that you're supposed to disconnect when you're... Shut up. How about you disconnect from my business? How's that? I hope everyone has a great Thanksgiving. Be nice to Brian Suits and Brandy Cruz in my absence. I would really appreciate that. I mean, you can give them a little bit of a hard time, but, you know, don't go overboard. Thank you so much for tuning in. Have a good night.